The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Vakhtang Gamalari is a therapist and self-proclaimed psychoanalyst working in New York City who is influenced by the ideas of Jacques Lacan, and this week he stopped by to discuss the book Television and the televised broadcast that the book is based on. It's Thursday, August 24th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you're looking for a book to help you understand psychology, one from Zero Books, you should pick up The Off-Modern by Ron Roberts. Some other Zero Books titles worth having would be Anselm Japp's The Writing on the Wall, which is a collection that brings an understanding of Marx's value theory to bear on political questions. And it's a collection of essays from 2007 through 2010. And of course, you should also buy Angela Nagel's Kill All Normies. You should just run right out and get that. It's turning out to be a great conversation piece, this book. It's guaranteed to transform any leftist get-together into a struggle session. If you enjoy the podcast, consider joining the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast that's entitled Inside Zero Books, and which sometimes features the second half of conversations with Zero Squared guests, and this week it's going to, and sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers, like C. Derek Varn, about the state of the left. Zero Books Club members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops with Zero Books authors and others. The music you're listening to is a piano cover of Hurt by Nine Inch Nails. But in just a moment, you'll be hearing the truth, but not all of it. Vakhtang Gamalari is a therapist and self-proclaimed psychoanalyst working in New York City who is influenced by the ideas of Jacques Lacan. This is his second time recording for this podcast, but the first time I had a psychological breakthrough and decided to keep that recording to myself. I look forward to asking questions, as I think he is the one supposed to know. Vakhtang Gamalari, thanks for coming on the Zero Books podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So what we're going to be talking about today is a book and a movie, or a television program, called Television. And the first section that we'll kind of be talking about is the introduction to Jacques Lacan's lecture, which he recorded and then was broadcast on television, I think back in the, was it in the 70s? And this was by
Jacques Alain Miller.
And he is probably the most famous proponent of Lacanian psychoanalysis around after Lacan.
Yeah, definitely. It's a very interesting relationship they had. And I think some of it unearths in this television series.
Was the dialogue at the outset of the book Television a fiction, or was that based on a real exchange? Who is the woman in that dialogue supposed to be?
Yeah, I think that is some fiction written by Miller. I think what it is interesting about this being the fiction that he's talking with somebody in New York. It's this, I think, reflection of this kind of fantasy that I think a lot of Lacanians have, that it's very important to bring Lacan to United States, you know. And I don't know how much has Lacan really crossed Atlantic, but I think it's interesting to see this desire.
I would say that the criticism expressed at the beginning of the book by the American fictional character, by the woman that Miller invents would be my own criticism, especially when I came to it for the first time. I've tried to watch this lecture more than once, and this is the first time I got through half of it. I find that Lacan is almost impenetrable, even when he's speaking. Usually when someone gives a lecture, and certainly when they give a lecture with as much theatricality in it as Lacan uses in his lecture, there is at least a feeling that you get that you understand, even if you, on retrospect, you know, looking back on it, realize you missed the point or couldn't summarize it, that while you're listening, at least you're swept along. In this case, quite the opposite happened. Was that an intentional tactic that Lacan was using, and why would he do such a thing?
He is not really trying to talk to as many listeners as he can. He's kind of thinking about this targeted audience who will click with what he's saying because they'll be in this discourse that he hope some people to be, which is analytic discourse. And that does not necessarily mean that they're practicing analysts or something, because actually he is very critical of, International Psychoanalytic Association and most analysts, and actually accuses them that they are making too much sense, and that making sense, for example, about sexual relations is not necessarily leading them anywhere. It's bringing them again to this failure. And
on the one hand, because I have some experience with Lacan through Zizek, I'm sympathetic to that notion that maybe a psychoanalyst could make too much sense. But on the other hand, if I'm someone who's having sexual problems and I go to an analyst, and I feel confused, the last thing I want is for the analyst to deepen my confusion or to make me feel that my problems are nonsense.
Right, exactly. And, that's definitely also accusation that I think was hurled at Lacan when his lecture was interrupted by radical students a couple of years before this broadcast. You know, if you're talking about nothing to nobody, like, what is really there to say?
What is the risk for the patient if the analyst does give them information and meaning which fits into string of signifiers in a way that seems linear and coherent and accessible and transparent even? Why is that to be avoided according to Lacan?
Again, like, that's I think at the core of his teaching, that when there is this attempt at this sense of completion, kind of wholeness of meaning, he's able to question that and show how that's impossible without some fantasy, some kind of perversion of the field to perceive something, language that can never be really completed, as completed. So this impossibility of completion is what psychoanalysts, according to Lacan, should be engaging in, this experience of failure of these structural relations. And Lacan claims that this kind of failure reveals the whole structure itself. He says, you know, Miller asks him a question about hope. Lacan says that maybe I can't say anything about hope, but I can talk about ethics of from where are you hoping, from which position. So this idea of where are you in the structure.
So let me return to the text here, because at the beginning of the lecture and at the beginning of the introduction, both they spend some time on this claim that Lacan makes that he always speaks the truth, even though he never speaks the whole truth. And what I wrote down here, and I don't remember exactly what inspired me to write this down, but that when he says that he always speaks the truth, what he means is that he always speaks the truth at the level of enunciation, even if what he actually literally says might not be the truth. For instance, he might say something like, "I am lying," which paradoxically could not be the truth or a lie, but at the level of connotation appears as the truth. So I guess what I'm wondering is, does the truth always have to have a kind of a rhetorical or fictional or a character, or does it have to always arrive through connotation rather than direct enunciation?
Because truth is kind of a byproduct of any speech act. It is not exactly inscribed in it, and Lacan is talking about this decoding, which is, I think, different from, for example, deconstruction that was happening on the other spectrum of end of spectrum of, you know, French thought at a time. This decoding that he also traces back to Freud is what allows us to kind of get to truth that is inevitable effect of speech through the language.
When I think of decoding, I think of taking a text or a line of numbers or any code, deciphering it, and coming to its actual concrete, limited meaning. And when I think of deconstruction, I think of taking any text or code and demonstrating how no one meaning can be justifiably extracted from it, but many meanings or plurality of meanings can be found there. Lacan seems to me to be someone who falls on both sides of this distinction between deconstruction and decoding. Like, decoding, according to Lacan, doesn't give you some final meaning, but it does give you a meaning or a truth. So how is it that the plurality of meaning and the truth can fit together? Or how can the truth and the both the true and the false be decoded out of, say, a Freudian slip or a pun?
There is multitude, and at the same time there is oneness and repetition of certain structure, which is functioning as one. So the relationship of this disjointed kind of language of multitude and plurality of meanings that exist, for example, in the unconscious, Lacan is engaging in this formation of certain social links. And this is very central to television, because he talks a lot about four discourses that he introduced in late 60s, early 70s. And it's his kind of very minimal arithmetic way of sharing this idea, how this multitude engages with the void, with that excess that is object R in any form of social link, the discourse. But that's like this Lacan's theory of four discourses that's very central to this time period, late Lacan, so-called.
Four discourses is a concept developed by French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan. He argued that there were four fundamental types of discourse. He defined the four discourses, which he called master, university, hysteric, and analyst, and suggested that these related dynamically to one another. The discourse of the master represents the struggle for mastery, domination, and penetration, and was based on Hegel's master-slave dialectic. The discourse of the university, supervision and worship of objective knowledge, usually in the unacknowledged service of some external master discourse. The discourse of the hysteric, symptoms embodying and revealing resistance to the prevailing master discourse. And the discourse of the analyst, deliberate subversion of the prevailing master discourse. According to Wikipedia and the psychoanalytic theory of Jacques Lacan, the objet petit A stands for the unattainable object of desire. It is something called the object cause of desire. Lacan always insisted that the term should remain untranslated.
See what real life can bring. It's Coke for the taste of your life.
Well, I feel like I'm very American, because what I want to do now is like shift this into clear enunciation and concrete detail. So let me just see if I can give you a scenario which you can then decode. So I come into your office and I lie down on the couch, and you're the Lacanian analyst and I'm the patient. Where is the petite A in that scenario?
The petite A has to be embodied by the analyst. This is embodiment through desire. The desire has to be to becoming out of this position of excess meaning, of something that is not understood, and being there as this kind of interlocutor with the person who comes into the office.
Right. When I'm lying down on the couch, in order for this analysis to work, I have to assume, okay, I'm a little confused, because the petite A, I thought, was associated with the real, that it was a bit of reality that kind of gets past our symbolic filters and can't be symbolized.
Exactly. So it can be almost invisible. I think that's why, like, when you see setup of psychoanalytic office, the psychoanalyst supposed to sit behind the couch. Lately they've been, I've seen a lot of advertisement for psychoanalysis, and they kind of put this couch in front, so you're not in this invisible spot anymore. And so you have to produce this good meaning of, like, what's going on with the person who's right in front of you, and you have to give very knowledgeable report. And you're kind of like in this invisible field, but this exactly amplifies your role as subject supposed to know, because then person whom you're listening to is not even able to see you, and as they're assuming that you are that person with answers, interesting things happen. And this is called transference, and it's completely central to psychoanalytic process. But Lacan is again taking this and looking at it from the perspective of what kind of discourse is established between two people, for example, here in analytic practice, and that allows him to then critique the International Psychoanalytic Society that they are perverting this discourse and effectively presenting themselves, creating this insurance against analytic discourse. And so the real analytic discourse can never really show itself.
Okay, but if I'm a stupid, empiricist, and you ask me, to find what's real, I'm going to look for a sensible object, something that I can know, that I can fully explain, and that I can – that's tangible to me. And this idea that the real is a performance, and that it's based on where the analyst sits and the kind of invisible authority and the play acting that the analyst is doing, and I guess that a patient is suckered into. so I'm giving you some of this resistance here. that seems very far away from what I would normally consider to be real. It would be that would be a kind of fantasy that you're entering into with the analyst.
I was watching. Also, there's the first two lectures are on YouTube. I was actually seeing how different the English translation is from what some of the things he says in actual video, and then compared to French version. This is also different. All of this is different, and all of this has Miller's hand in it, because he really wanted to be this guy who would process this for everybody. When I was listening to these YouTube videos, I was sort of started recognizing more that how much Lacan was referring to experience. The experience shows us. The experience shows us this. He said several times, and Lacan being this kind of symbol of anti-empiricism, it was interesting to always hear him talk like this, because what he's talking about is that there is constant engagement in the culture and so on with things that are not necessarily easy to bring into language, and that, this is something out of our experience, that it fails, for example, Miller, also trying to be contrarian, asks him, we know so much about sex, why can't we still have good, good sex? So it is there, the problem is also in the experience, and the failure to symbolize what's going on with this problem is an experience somewhere in the United States as well as in France and any other part of speaking world. So in this way, this failure is the universal bit that really actually makes it very easy to kind of engage with this process of, I think easy. I think that there is nothing that complicated with psychoanalysis, but that engagement is very available. And it's, I think, in this form scientific, and Lacan then lashes out at other ways of trying to cover this up, with the idea of soul or energy or some other.
Yeah, kind
of,
well, I want to get to what he says about the soul, but before I do, I just want to say, when I try to imagine or remember an experience that seems similar to the experience you describe, where you're the patient lying down on the couch and you're talking to an invisible other who's, maybe chiming in occasionally, but with an almost an anonymous voice that's replying to you, that's the analyst. What I'm reminded of is actually a moment which was traumatic, when my dog died when I was in my teens, and the dog died because everyone in our family had given the dog its antibiotics. It had been hit by a car, but didn't die then. It got an infection. And then everyone, we weren't communicating very well with the family, so all of us gave the dog its antibiotics instead of one of us being assigned the task of doing that. It overdosed on the medication and violently died. But while it was dying, I went outside. I don't remember why I went outside. It was cold. It was winter. And I remember pleading with God that I would believe in him if he would make my dog better. And somehow because at that moment I didn't really believe in God. I was an atheist. But I was nonetheless pleading with God about my dog. And it seemed, and of course the dog died. So God, you know, screwed me over on that deal. But that realizing, feeling as though I really could talk to God even though I didn't believe in him was, somehow reminds me of this analytic relationship.
And it's interesting that you say that, because in television, Lacan is talking about relation of domestic animals to the unconscious.
He does mention that, doesn't he?
I'm not able to find it right now. But yeah, he talks about this in just in terms of relationship of animals to the unconscious. Then also, I think Zizek has this whole psychoanalytic analysis of Hitchcock's Birds that he got famous for. It was a big YouTube hit, I remember. What you were saying about your pet is exactly, I think, this kind of structure of, on one hand, having this relation to the void and the big other, you know, the void in your world of objects that you have attachment to, and then engagement with this gaze, right? That is supposed to be also point that kind of ties it all together and eliminates this void through leaf system of maybe some oneness of some higher power, right?
Yeah, I mean, Lacan talks about this gaze at the very beginning of his lecture, where he says that he associates it with television, and he says that he is going to be speaking to the gaze, but not directly. He's going to also be speaking for the gaze. And I was wondering, why doesn't he address the gaze directly? He says he won't address the gaze directly. I mean, I did. When I was talking to God about my dog, I was directly talking to the gaze. I guess that was maybe because he's the analyst, he doesn't talk to the gaze, but talks for it. I'll just leave it there. That's my suggestion. But what's your answer to that question of why he won't speak to the gaze directly, but instead speaks for it?
Well, we're talking about this furniture. It has to do with positioning of the gaze, right, of the subject that it's supposed to know, right? Like, God is also supposed to give you answers, right? So he's not, and then if one addresses it directly, one has to completely, in a certain way, hystericize themselves, because that's the analytic discourse that, you know, then one has to be talking to absolute silence of this gaze, this kind of.
So if you speak for the gaze, you allow yourself to question it and provide answers for it without being in as much of an hysterical position?
Yeah, speaking for the gaze would be speaking for this position of analyst and analytic discourse, and how everybody should, you know, try to look at themselves, how they think that gaze is looking at them. But at this point, Lacan was not talking into silence. He was talking with Miller, who was playing a certain role of this like fake opponent. And in this regard, this was no longer him talking to the gaze, but him talking to the other, the real other, so to say, the opponent.
Does he say that he's talking to the other?
I don't remember exactly him saying, but Lacan in the past says that when he's getting this silence from listeners, he interprets it as the silence of the analyst, that they're analyzing him, and then he can be in the position of hysteric, kind of, treating his seminar as his analysis, so to say.
La dire toute, c'est impossible matériellement sans les mots qui y manquent. C'est même par cet impossible que la vérité touche au réel.
Ici, on est à la télé.
It was simply made as a documentary supposed to present Lacanian theory to a white public, I think, for the second channel of the French state TV.
J'y suppose. Analyste.
L'inconscient, quel drôle de mot.
Oui, je suis d'accord.
What I appreciate is this inversion, reversal of the role between public image and private. It's that this total denigration, disappearance of this warm human person, this for me is the idea of ideology. The central idea of ideology for me is not this idea is determining you are a Christian, you are a Marxist or whatever, today liberal, I don't know, but the idea is precisely that ideological propositions do not determine us totally. We cannot be reduced to our public image. There is a warm human being behind. I think this is ideology at its purest. The most horrible anti-ideological act for me, and really horrible, terrifying, is to fully identify with the ideological image. The ultimate act is what we think is our true self. That there is the true acting, and that usually our truth, to that to which we are really committed existentially, is in our acts more than in what is supposed to be behind the act. So again, my point is that I like philosophy as an anonymous job, not as this kind of, look, the way he moves now and so on, these gestures. I find this ridiculous. He emphasizes, one cannot say all the truth. It's impossible materially.
Materiellement.
This ridiculous emphasis. I think it's a pure fake, an empty gesture, as if he makes a deep point there. He does not.
Mon nomme von Uxkull.
I read Lacan in a very classical way. What interests me are his proposition, the underlying logic, not his style. His style is a total fake, I think. I try to forget it, I try to repress it. Maybe it works as a strategy at a certain point, why not? First you have to seduce people with obscure statements, but I hate this kind of approach. I'm a total enlightenment person. I believe in clear statements and so on. And I'm for Lacan because, again, I think, to make it very clear, that it's not that Lacan is just bluffing, in the sense that there is nothing behind this obscurity. The whole point of my work is that you can translate Lacan into clear terms.